Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday morning. It's August 20th. Right now, we've got 66 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies. Heber City reporting 62 degrees at the airport. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Thursday. And, well, we're going to be looking at partly sunny skies, but it is going to be hot out there, folks. Temperatures climbing to around 90 degrees for us in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the upper 90s in the Heber Valley. So make sure you're staying hydrated. Don't forget that sunscreen, SPF 30 or greater. You could burn in less than 10 to 15 minutes. It'll be back to the dog days of summer for us across the area. Now, as we go into your Friday, hey, we love a Friday. We're looking at partly cloudy skies. Now, we will introduce a chance of a few isolated thunderstorms developing, particularly in the afternoon and evening hours across the Wasatch Back, with high temperatures still climbing before that to around 90 degrees in Park City, and will be in the mid-90s in the Heber Valley. I think we'll have a better chance of isolated to scattered showers and thunderstorms as we head into the weekend. As we go into your Saturday, we'll call it about a 40 to 50% chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms across the area during the afternoon hours. Temperatures will climb only in the mid-80s thanks to the extra cloud cover and showers across the Park City area. And we'll be looking at high temperatures only in the low 90s in the Heber Valley with that chance of a few scattered showers and storms. Again, as we go into your Sunday, look for a chance of those scattered showers and storms in the afternoon hours. Temperatures remaining a little on the cooler side with highs only in the mid-80s on your Sunday in Park City, and high temperatures will be only around 90 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we head into early next week, we kind of stick with this somewhat unsettled weather pattern. There's not going to be a ton of moisture with this monsoon surge, but there will be that chance of those daily showers and thunderstorms. I think still a good chance of scattered showers and storms developing in the afternoon hours on your Monday with those high temperatures in the low 80s in Park City, highs in the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. And then we'll slowly start to trend lower with that daily rain chance, but temperatures staying in the low 80s in Park City and highs near 90 in the Heber Valley through middle of next week. That's a good latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Councilmember Roger Armstrong, recapping yesterday's meeting. Chrissy Barner is the president of the Mountainside Resort Foundation. She'll have details on the establishment of this new foundation to help champion long-term community stewardship. Then I'll introduce you to the new Utah Avalanche Executive Director, Naz Kurth, discussing some of their upcoming winter operations and an outlook at the Super El Nino. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include author Stuart Firestein, who in his new book contends that uncertainty and unanswered questions are not weaknesses of science. That's what makes discovery possible. Then Lena Goldstein and Benjamin Beckman of Park City Opera explain the hidden science behind one of the oldest forms of musical storytelling and how physics and physiology help turn famous tales into sound. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio, heard, of course, every Thursday from 9 to 10. Taking a look now at some local news, Summit County has seized the communication records of the Park City Chief of Police and a former county sheriff. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports it's part of a felony investigation into Wasatch County Sheriff Jared Rigby.
A recently unsealed search warrant reveals new details about the felony obstruction of justice investigation into Wasatch County Sheriff Jared Rigby. The warrant sought the call and text records of Rigby, Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter, and former Summit County Sheriff Dave Edmonds. An attorney representing both Carpenter and Edmonds says neither did anything wrong. The Summit County Attorney's Office confirmed to KPCW in May it was investigating Rigby for his alleged misconduct ahead of the high-profile Corey Richens murder trial. Rigby says he acted lawfully. A sworn statement from the investigator who applied for the warrant paints a clearer picture of what transpired. The attorney's office has said its investigation concerns an anonymous letter it received in January, about 1 month before the Richens trial began. The warrant says it contained 13 allegations about Summit County Detective Eric Maynard, who was a possible witness in the trial. According to the warrant, the 13 allegations in the anonymous letter match the content of a public records request that Edmonds, the former Summit County Sheriff, submitted to the Heber City Police Department in December 2025. Edmonds was allegedly seeking Maynard's personnel file. Prosecutors say a handwriting expert reviewed handwriting in Edmonds' request, and the expert says it's a possible match for Rigby's handwriting. Summit County Sheriff Casey Bates tells investigators that Rigby presented the same 13 allegations to her at a meeting in early January after Maynard filed to run against Rigby for Wasatch County Sheriff. The warrant states, quote, Bates had the clear impression that Mr. Rigby was intimating that unless Mr. Maynard withdrew his candidacy, this information would become public and either directly or indirectly have a negative impact on the prosecution of Corey Richens. Within 30 minutes of meeting with Rigby, Bates allegedly received a call from Park City Police Chief Carpenter. According to investigators, Carpenter also told her that the allegations against Maynard could have an impact on the Corey Richens trial. The search warrant says both he and Rigby urged Bates to talk to the Summit County attorney about them. The Summit County Attorney's Office served Verizon Wireless with the search warrant for Rigby's, Edmonds, and Carpenter's cell records on February 11th. Court records show the company turned over data by May 20th, but what the search yielded is not public. The warrant was sealed and became public August 11th. Greg Scordis, the attorney representing Edmonds and Carpenter, says the results of the search, quote, have proven conclusively that there was no wrongdoing by either of these men. The Summit County Attorney's Office tells KPCW it does not comment on active investigations, and Rigby has not been charged with a crime. More information about the unsealed warrant is at kpcw.org. KPCW's Grace Dorfler contributed to this report. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with a recap of yesterday's Summit County Council meeting, I have Councilmember Roger Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with Ordinance 1016. The council received a number of public comments on this new rezone process for the Snyderville Basin Development Code yesterday. Unfortunately, the live stream on Facebook stopped before the council voted, so we didn't get to see the result. Did the council approve or deny the ordinance?
We did not. We neither approved nor denied the ordinance. We requested some additional time to really take a closer look at it, because if we're going to make any changes, and at this point, it's going to be a challenge for me to get there, but I need to read it much more closely. I think we've got to make sure the language is extremely precise. And it's an opportunity. We're on the threshold of getting a rewrite of the general plan and the development code from each of our planning commissions. I believe those two processes are ongoing. And we're making what I regard as a pretty substantial change to this section of the code. And a lot of this seems to relate to housing. I've been asking for some sort of a housing strategy from the council rather than looking to a housing authority to provide the council. It's our job to determine policy. And I think we're getting close to likely having a strategic housing meeting. We had one last year, that was productive. And we agreed to gather again and have that discussion, and we just haven't done it. And that's really about where do we want to site housing? How much do we really want to build? Park City has said they want to accommodate 15% of their workforce. We haven't put a number down. We pulled 1,500 units out of the air as a goal, but we really haven't said who do we want to build them for. If we want to build them for this group, what kind of amenities are they going to be looking for? What kind of challenges do some of the deed restrictions create for them as they grow and progress? We're still being reactive to proposals coming in or saying, well, let's build something somewhere. And this ties into that. This is an outgrowth of the Klein-Dolly process.
Okay, maybe just a step back. Maybe explain what that ordinance is supposed to do.
So currently, if you want to rezone, and zoning in the county is the fundamental imprint of what we want the county to look like. We create zones, and if you remember, we last did it 9 years ago, so we were very late. We should take a look at it far more often than this. But 9 years ago, Pat Putt and his team were at grocery stores. They were at post offices. They were all over the city, all over the county, rather, taking input from residents about their neighborhoods. What did they want to see there? What do they not want to see there? How do they want to grow? It was a very, very detailed process with a lot of public input. That led to us adopting those maps, the neighborhood maps, those maps about what kinds of uses could be in certain zones and other details about what should be there. Currently the zoning process is, if you want to rezone your property, you come to the county, you make a pitch to the county council, the planning commission, the county manager, whoever you start with, and say, I want to rezone this from rural residential to community commercial, which allows for mixed use and certain other uses not allowed in rural residential. That leads to a process. You have to come with a lot of great detail. What does the project look like? It requires precise engineering drawings. It requires consent from, oddly enough, the post office, the fire department, and others saying, yeah, this is feasible to do all of this, and this zone does make sense because it could satisfy all of these requirements. And essentially what the planning department ran into in the Klein-Dolly situation is they're the developer. It's a public-private partnership. We all want to do this, and ultimately the county will be the applicant for a rezone if it goes forward. The developer is in a position of having to spend a lot of money to get all of those really precise drawings done. And the fear is that if he does all that and we go through the rezone process, that something could happen, public outcry, whatever, could kill it, and then he just flushes that money that he spent. So he met with the planners and tried to come up with, I'm not blaming this on him, but requested a process that would allow for detail without the precise detail of the things that the county council is probably not most concerned about. So this is trying to find the balance of that. It's still not going to, it's going to be with cost, but it won't be the extreme cost. That's what they're trying to get to.
Yeah, so it sounds like staff added some guardrails since the council's last discussion on it. So like if a rezone is approved, the code would now approve a development agreement. Does that help or hurt the case?
Well, I think that was always there. What they did when they first came to us, they said that rather than all of those details that I mentioned, essentially a full-blown plan, this is what it looks like, that they would come with a concept development plan. And there was no meat on that bone. It was like a general description of, you know, like, where do you want to put this and what goes over here and what goes over there? It was very light. And we said, that's not enough. It's got to be extremely detailed so we know exactly what is being proposed. So they came back with that. They put a lot more detail in what would comprise that concept development plan. They also provided for a series of public hearings. Because again, if you go with the notion that zoning is done with public input, rezoning should be done with significant public input, because we're changing what we promised we would do based on the input we got. So now they come in and have a planning meeting with the planning department to kind of describe what they want to do. Then there's, I believe there's a public hearing. Then if it continues to proceed, if they don't get a no kind of in that early stage so that they avoid a lot of costs, then it goes to the Planning Commission. Public hearings at the Planning Commission, one or more. Then the Planning Commission makes a decision. It gets handed up to the County Council. We have the ultimate decision-making authority. And the county's decision on zoning and rezoning in particular is discretionary. We can decide to rezone or not. And one of the things that I think there was some concern with is just looking at the language, are we including anything in here that would impair our ability to make that decision in a discretionary way? Or if at any part of the process, has it become so vested that we've got a problem and we can't say no?
Yeah, and then that tie-in, you know, with the affordable housing plan, it's... I mean, something like this is almost needed in order for units to be affordable, no?
No, I would argue that what's needed is for the council to make a decision about housing and for the council to say, if we take a look, to really take a look and decide, where do we have infill? And one of those, Klein Dolly perhaps, is an example of that. The tennis courts in Pine Brook was an example of an infill parcel where we could put 12 units or whatever we put. Does it satisfy whatever needs? We've not gone into any kind of weeds, any kind of detail with housing. We've just got this notion out there of affordable housing, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. And if we rely on developers to come to us and say, we want to build this and we're going to give you 20% affordable housing or 30% affordable housing. I think Dakota Pacific is something like 50 or 55%, but that's because the county included 167 or 169 units that pumped it up a bit. But Lincoln Station was able to do a project at 57% affordable. They went through a rezone, the only rezone that's occurred since I've been on council, to get the ability to do that. And it worked. They were able to afford to do that. So some of this stuff about the costs associated with it, it's been working so far, and it's limited. I don't want to line at the door of rezones. That starts to really disrupt what we've done in terms of planning. So making sure that that's not what winds up in this particular ordinance, I think, is important.
Okay. Did you schedule then that housing summit this year?
I don't know that we've settled on a date, but Candace and I met with the county manager yesterday and said, let's get it on the calendar. And I think we're looking at a date in October, one or more dates. It may require more than one day.
Okay. Basin Recreation downsized its bond request from $150 million to $71 million. The council went ahead and approved that $71 million last night. So what made that larger number just less favorable?
The larger number, it just included a lot. It was a giant number. We've not had a bond that size before. And we were really afraid that the voters might look at us as if we had lost our minds allowing something like that to go forward. So we asked Basin Rec to go back and re-examine it. And that, you know, to his credit, Rob Parrish, the director of Basin Rec, he took a lot of public input, and there were a lot of asks from the public. And he was trying to come up with a plan that could accommodate in some way all of those asks. He wanted to give the public what it was asking for. And, you know, if I walk into a car dealership and start asking, it's going to get into a pretty expensive car. And I think that's what happened. There were just climbing walls and aquatics and a lot of stuff built in that I don't think that bond would have gone forward. And I think it would have created ill will among the public that we would even ask for that. I think this one at least deserves a chance for Basin Rec to describe exactly what they want to do, and they haven't figured that quite yet. I think they're up against a deadline for bonding versus having a complete design and us at, you know, late stage saying, look, go back and come back with something far less, okay? So they don't know what far less is, but they're going to have a chance to make that argument to the public. And I like it in these kinds of tax situations where the public has the right to listen and make a decision by voting.
Yeah, so when will Basin Rec be providing more information, more details on what that $71 million will pay for?
The next public hearing is September 23rd, and we'll hear then. Hopefully they'll have a little bit more detail.
Okay, but at this point, it will be on November's ballot at $71
million. It will.
Okay. And then how does this affect the planning process for that Klein Dolly parcel? Because that's where one of the field houses that Basin Rec originally proposed was supposed to go.
It's a good question. I don't know that we've gotten to that point yet, you know, trying to figure out the fit of that field house there. I think we're all convinced that's probably a good place. I've always thought that Pine Brook Jeremy Ranch area really is kind of the center point, I think, of our population right now, has been for a while. And we require people to drive in to use a variety of fitness facilities, athletic facilities. There's not a lot available out there. And I've always thought that that would be a good place for a fitness facility. I didn't contemplate aquatics and gyms and things like that, but I thought a fitness facility might make sense. And I think what we heard last night is that the primary location for a facility is probably going to be in the Silver Creek Village area. And then they would also consider a more modest fitness type facility over on Klein Dolly. So I think they're still kind of keeping a mark there as a possibility, but we'll see if that's going to evolve.
All right, the council yesterday also approved the second floor renovations at the former Skull Candy building, now the Peak Center. Staff threw out a lot of numbers, so is it going to cost more or less than what was expected?
It's a good question. What I took away from it is I think we're now going to the second floor build-out phase two. I think the budget looks like it's about $1.8 million on that. And then when you add the FF&E, it takes it up to about $2.2 million. I think it's close to the budget, but it's likely to be a bit more. But I don't think it's, you know, it didn't go double over budget or 50% over.
So are we still within the $30 million bond that was used to buy and renovate?
Yes.
Okay. So the second floor will include everything at the Richens Building except for the library and DMV. It'll house the communications, some health department offices. And, of course, with the health department moving, that's put extra space at Round Valley up for grabs. What's the status of negotiations here for People's Health Clinic and with the Jackie's Recovery Services? Because you have, the county has a contract with Jackie Recovery and needs to find some space for them.
Sure. As it relates to occupancy of the health department, that is by contract, health department and People's Health Clinic. That's what the contract says. People's Health Clinic prepaid a 40-year lease at $1 a year. So they paid their $40 at the beginning, and they occupy that facility. The health department occupies the facility under the ground lease with IHC. And no other nonprofit can go in there unless IHC says, okay. I've not received an official update, but unofficially I've heard that the discussions are going well with People's Health Clinic and the health department, and they've sort of started to align on, I think the most recent meeting was earlier this week, and I'm optimistic that they're going to work that out. As it relates to Jackie's, I think that the county manager is looking for opportunities there. Keep in mind that the contract with Jackie's is for Jackie's to provide service within the MCOT, which is the mobile crisis team. And we took a tour of the Justice Department recently, and it's the Cadillac of all Justice Departments I've ever seen. And I would hope that there might be, you know, some means of accommodating some stuff there. That build out on the sheriff's side is still happening. And I don't know exactly what Jackie's needs are, but I think we'll be able to find some alternative for them. I thought they thought it would just be easy to slot it in there. And given the numbers, for me personally, given the numbers, 21,500 patient visits a year, the People's Health Clinic provides across a multitude of practice areas by extremely experienced doctors, highly trained, including behavioral health, with a Latino population that's very substantial. If I had to balance the equities, I think the balance would fall on People's Health Clinic, in my opinion.
Okay. Finally, just the council also renamed Tech Center Drive to Nordic Drive last night. Was there any support for what the Six Ridge Partners or Dakota Pacific wanted, Altus Drive?
I don't recall that there was.
Okay. Nordic Drive it is.
Yes.
Anything else, Roger?
That's all I've got. Thanks, Lisa.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
That's Summit County Council Member Roger Armstrong. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Mountainside Resort Foundation was formally launched in July of this year. It's connected to Extel's Deer Valley East Village development, and in studio with details about the foundation and the work it plans to do, I have Chrissy Banner. She is president of the Mountainside Resort Foundation. Good morning, Chrissy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So the foundation, as we mentioned, a new organization. What's the foundation's purpose, and I guess what do you want people in the Wasatch Back to understand about your role?
Yes. Good question. So Mountainside Resort Foundation is a nonprofit that Extel Development established. And really the goal is to invest in our local community and serve, make sure that we are good stewards of the land and good neighbors to those around us. We were established to serve as a permanent community-centered institution that grows alongside Deer Valley East Village and directs resources towards issues that support the people who live and work in this region.
Okay, so how independent is the foundation then from Extel and the Deer Valley East Village Development?
It is separate, totally separate, but the board members all work for Extel and on the Extel project. But we are, you know, separate organization that will hopefully last well beyond Extel's presence here.
Okay, so what does community stewardship mean to you in practical terms?
Yeah, so we have five main pillars of kind of areas that we support. So the first would be community partnerships that address regional needs with creativity and scale. We support athletics, so that's facility improvements, sponsorships for youth, disabled, and veteran athletes. Conservation is a big component to Mountainside Resort Foundation, so protecting open space and natural areas, primarily supporting the work of Utah Open Lands, and we did a 3,100-acre conservation easement ourselves, so that was the 45th star conservation easement on our land. And then two more, we have public education and cultural programming, so just trying to make things more accessible and affordable for people in this community. And then environmental stewardship and wildfire resilience is a big one as well.
Sure. And as I mentioned, the foundation, I guess, is going to be funded through a community reinvestment fee on property transactions within the East Village. So
exactly.
How much money do you anticipate that generating as the development goes
It's pretty substantial. So, I mean, several million over the next several years. So we have a pretty big pool of funds. And what's special about that is as the community grows over at East Village, so does our funding base. So the more we have sales taking place over at East Village, the more good we're able to do in the community.
So is there a percentage on the sales price? Is that how it works?
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Like a tenth of a percent?
It's just over 1%.
Okay. All right. And did it start from the first sale?
It did. Yep. So the first sale was exempt, actually, for the first developer sale was exempt, and then every other sale has that community reinvestment fee.
Okay. So who determines how the money is spent?
So we have a board of five members, and it's really a team effort. I act as the president, but definitely everything's a conversation between the five of us. And we just get inquiries in. It's a very simple process at this point. We're working to get a little bit more formal, but we're still pretty new. People reach out and, you know, tell us about what they're interested in having us support, and then I propose it to the board. We have quarterly meetings, and we either approve or deny, and it kind of works that easy.
Yeah. Some foundations have, you know, kind of just application periods.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you'll set it up?
We are working to set it up that way, yes. So right now it's been more ad hoc, but as we're getting more formalized and as we're growing and as our pool of funds is growing as well, we know we need to become a little bit more sophisticated. So we're working on setting up an application process. We'll probably do our first one early this coming spring. So about January, February 2027, open that up for about a 60-day period to accept applications and then get back to everybody and let them know if they've been approved and how much, and then go from there.
Yeah, so are you creating an endowment and then plan to just give, I guess, grant, I don't say give giveaway, but
yeah.
grant the kind of the interest bearing from the endowment?
Yes.
Is that how it's going to work?
I don't know if we'll set up a formal endowment. We're just a 501(c) right now, but that's how it will work. Yeah.
Okay. And then do you plan to disclose how the money is spent and to whom?
Yes, we plan to do more reporting and definitely kind of get out there in terms of how much we've spent and both in-kind and in-cash donations, and just let the community know what good we're doing and let them know we're out there and so more people can reach out and be a part of it as well.
So what types of organizations do you think are kind of eligible for these grants?
So anybody who falls within kind of our five main pillars, as I listed, but things that are promoting education, youth, athletics, trail building, conservation, so, yeah, other nonprofits in the area is really our primary focus.
Yeah, and do you anticipate, you know, kind of small community grants or major capital projects?
We have some major capital projects, yeah. So one of the biggest ones that we're working on right now is our wildfire mitigation. So we have helped further establish a network of Alert West-powered wildfire detection cameras. So we're partnering with the University of Utah, the Utah Division of Natural Resources, and Wasatch County Fire District. And this is a pretty substantial program for the entire region. So the main goal is to be able to detect wildfires when they hit, and these cameras have large radiuses of areas that they kind of monitor and then can immediately alert the Wasatch Fire District if something is detected. And with that, we also have a 10 million gallon on-mountain water storage pond dedicated to fire suppression, as well as our snowmaking network is actually engineered to double as fire water access. So that's able to run at full capacity during fire season. So if something were to be detected, we could kind of fire it up and help put out the fire as well. So it's a really cool program that we're really proud of. And actually part of the impetus for wanting to set up this more sophisticated structure where we could actually accept grants and be able to do more regional work beyond just East Village, specific to the wildfire mitigation.
Okay, so I read 23 wildfire detection cameras.
That's right.
Will those be just within the East Village Mm-mm. area, or we're talking
Good question. Yeah, countywide.
Summit and Wasatch County?
Yep, mm-hmm. yep. We have three that are dedicated to just overseeing the Deer Valley East Village project, but they have pretty large radiuses, so we're able to monitor a lot of acreage at this point, which is awesome.
All right, conservation and open space protection, you said also among your priorities.
Yes.
So how will you decide which land or conservation projects, you know, are worthy of support?
Yeah, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we're definitely focused on preserving viewshed. That's a big component for us. I mean, people come to Utah and want to recreate here and buy second homes here because it's such a beautiful area. That was part of the impetus for the 45th Star Conservation Preserve. So we were able to put 3,100 acres into conservation and reduce our density and not build on that area. It's protection for wildlife habitat and viewshed, trails and recreation for the summer. But further areas are still to be determined in terms of how and where we would help preserve further lands. But we're closely partnered with Utah Open Lands and Wendy Fisher and her team over there. We were just at their gala on Saturday night. So supporting them and all the work they're doing in the region.
All right. Workforce housing is listed as a future priority. So
yes.
What can a foundation like yours do to address the affordability crisis we have in the Wasatch Back?
Yes, that is a great question. So one of the things that we're doing that's super exciting is Extel itself as a for-profit foundation and Mountainside Resort Foundation are kind of partnering on our workforce housing program. So we have acquired 70 acres across Highway 40. Called the Marina West parcel right there adjacent to the Jordanelle State Park. And we're planning to build several hundred units of workforce housing. We're still determining the exact amount, but we will be prioritizing workforce housing for not only East Village, but hopefully for the region as a, as we know that this is an issue that every resort town faces, but we're adding to that quite a bit with the new hotels and the expanded terrain that we've brought on. So, yeah, super excited to work on that and address it up front.
Okay, so it sounds like you're actually going to put some money into workforce housing and not just supporting
right. Yes,
nonprofits we actually, doing the work.
Exactly, yeah. Yes, yes, absolutely. So we're planning to build ourselves several hundred units and primarily funded by Extel itself, but with some support from Mountainside Resort Foundation.
Okay, anything else you want us to know about...
No, other than that, you can feel free to reach out. My email is cbarner@extel.com, and that's how you can get in touch with me and get on our list. And if there's anything we can do to help support the community, we're always interested in learning more.
Okay. Christy Barner is president of the Mountainside Resort Foundation. Thanks so much for your time this
morning. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. The Park City Council will review updates to the Main Street area today. It could eventually mean wider sidewalks, one-way vehicle traffic, and even a gondola connecting Main Street to Deer Valley. In 2023, a committee drafted a proposed Main Street area plan and presented it to the community. The plan focused on future opportunities for Main Street and Sweet Alley with an emphasis on economic vitality ahead of the 2034 Olympic Games. The first draft included new hotels, public space improvements, workforce housing, a smaller Main Street post office, and a potential gondola connection to Deer Valley. Following public engagement in 2024, the Planning Committee refined its recommendations. Deputy City Manager Jody Emery says the Park City Council declined to adopt the full plan. Instead, council members directed staff to conduct a feasibility study focused on council priorities, which included costs, funding, and timelines.
That feasibility study is substantially complete. There are some concepts being presented. These are not final designs. Those have been included in the staff report. But it really does look at prioritizing pedestrians on Main Street, but also considers parking and making sure that we continue to provide parking opportunities.
With 5 to 10 years of life remaining on the southern portion of the China Bridge parking garage, one recommendation is to demolish that section. Emery says it remains to be seen whether that parking would be replaced here downtown.
If we're considering other opportunities for parking, such as the Gordo and Richardson park and rides that have been contemplated as part of Recreate 248, that would then relieve some of the parking pressure on Main Street. That's the idea. And there's also another element of this plan, that's the aerial transit. That also has is in progress with feasibility study.
A potential gondola could cost anywhere between $30 and $50 million, depending on the route it takes. Two alignments are being considered, one from Richardson Flat to Deer Alley Snow Park Lodge, and one from Main Street to Snow Park. Another recommendation would widen Main Street sidewalks by 2 feet on each side. That would require Main Street to become one way for vehicle traffic, with a lane for the trolley to travel up and down the street.
The idea is to make Main Street much more pedestrian friendly, but to also allow the circulation that we know people rely on to get to the businesses and the businesses would like to have.
Sweet Alley would also receive pedestrian improvements, including sidewalks on both sides and a multi-use service lane for Main Street business deliveries. The council will discuss the updated plan at its work session Thursday at 4 o'clock. The agenda and Main Street staff report are available online at kpcw.org. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Well, property taxes are going up in Heber City. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the 4.2% increase is lower than what leaders originally proposed.
Heber City residents will pay just over 4% more in property taxes in fiscal year 2027, the council decided at a meeting Tuesday. The 4.2% tax increase is down slightly from the 4.8% city staff originally requested. Finance Director Sarah Nagel emphasized the tax increase is needed to respond to inflation.
The increase means the city will maintain the same level of real dollars. If the city forgoes the increase, the city will have fewer real dollars to maintain the same level of service.
Some locals have opposed the move, saying it's already difficult to pay the bills. Councilmember Mike Johnston argued it's more fiscally responsible to raise taxes incrementally.
Is it better to wait 5, 6, 7 years and then have a big tax jump of 20%, 30%, like some cities are doing? Or is it better to do every 1 or 2 years a small incremental tax increase to stay ahead of our costs?
He said Heber's budget has no fluff.
You should be calling your congressman and senator and talking about the stupid war we're fighting and the tariffs we're putting on people. Those things are so significantly more costly to you than our $16 a year that we're asking for to cover staff costs.
Other council members also favored a gradual approach. Aaron Cheatwood said the city should consider a policy similar to West Valley cities, which responds to inflation every year.
I think that is prudent of us to think about staying up with inflation at a minimum.
The 4.2% increase means a resident with a home worth $850,000 will need to pay an extra $15 for the year instead of the $17 originally proposed. The city also adopted its fiscal year 2027 budget at the meeting Tuesday, including an $18.9 million general fund. For details about the budget, visit kpcw.org. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, the Utah Avalanche Center has a new executive director. That's following the departure of the previous director, Caroline Miller, this spring. And in the studio to introduce himself, I have Naz Kurth. Good morning.
Morning, Lizzie.
So first tell me about your name. It's unusual. Is it a nickname?
Sure, it is a nickname.
Okay,
short for Nazareth.
Nazareth, okay. You have spent much of your career in the outdoor industry, including executive leadership positions. So what attracted you to this job?
The mission. You know, the Utah Avalanche Center is focused on saving lives. And so they do that through avalanche forecasting, awareness, and education. And that was a really compelling thing for me.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, and the background you got.
Sure. I'm originally from the East Coast, from New Hampshire, but moved to Utah about 20 years ago. I've always been an avid climber and backcountry skier, and so being in Salt Lake has been kind of a dream with the access to the mountains.
Okay. And so as executive director, I mean, what is it that you do for the Utah Avalanche Center?
Sure. So the Friends of the Utah Avalanche Center is responsible for raising funds to help ensure that we've got great avalanche forecasting that continues. And then we also provide awareness and education programs so that we help people understand about avalanches in the backcountry.
Okay. And then you also have somebody that kind of oversees the staff. That's not your position, or is it?
It is, sure. So the UAC is a public-private partnership. Mm-hmm. So on the forecasting side, we work with the Forest Service, and Paige Bagnuco is the director there. And then on the nonprofit side, we do the raising the money and the education and the awareness.
Okay, so I guess how does it feel to go from somebody who relies on the UAC forecast and then to leading the organization that produces them?
Yeah, it's delightful to be kind of on the other side. I've used the UAC's forecast, you know, every day during the winter for the last 20 years. And to be on the other side and to see the support that the community provides is really impactful. I've been delightfully surprised at how many people come up and say, we love what you do and we want to continue to help support it.
Yeah. I guess as your first winter coming on, what are your priorities then for as you begin?
You know, our main priority is outreach, raising awareness and letting people know that they can get the forecast through our website, through our app, as well as through calling in and text as well. So we try and make the information as accessible as possible. And we're starting our big fund drive, the 33rd Backcountry Benefit at Black Diamond on September 10th. That's kind of the unofficial kickoff of the winter season.
Yeah, that's right. Tickets on sale now?
You bet.
Yeah. And then, of course, people can always hear the daily call in from your forecasters at 8:08 weekdays and 8:21 Saturday and Sunday. So with more people now skiing, snowboarding, snowmobiling, you know, recreating in the backcountry, how significant is that increase, I guess, from a safety perspective?
Well, it's been a dramatic increase. We've seen probably, you know, a 10x increase in the number of backcountry travelers, both mechanized and human-powered. So ensuring that people understand where they should be touring and when, and also assessing the risk is really important for us.
Yeah, so how is it that the Avalanche Center then works with the community to kind of teach them what they need to know before they head out?
Well, so we have the daily forecast, and one of the things that's unique about the UAC is we've got a very strong community observers. So people will be out, they'll do, you know, profiles, they'll dig, they'll assess, and then they'll write up and submit those observations. So any skier, any backcountry traveler can go on our website and take a look at the observations for specific areas, and that's really impactful.
Yeah. How do you reach out to people who may be new to the backcountry and don't necessarily think they need avalanche education?
Right. Well, we do it in a couple different ways. We have a Know Before You Go program, mm-hmm. where we go to schools, high schools, middle schools, to raise awareness about the realities of avalanches. And then we have a host of educational opportunities, Backcountry 101, which is sort of like a one-day primer, as well as things like companion rescue courses that are very accessible for the average user.
Yeah, it was interesting to learn from one of your forecasters that, you know, when it's green, you know, with the forecast kind of okay, I think that's like when most avalanche fatalities happen, when people think it's safe. But even though it may have a green rating, it's always dangerous, yeah?
Well, there's different rating scales, and there's sort of a five step. But when you get to moderate and considerable, sometimes people can make decisions that, you know, have consequences.
Yeah, I guess what are the biggest mistakes that happen when people interpret or use avalanche forecast? Just not knowing enough about it?
Correct, yeah. And so understanding the terrain, understanding the danger level, and being able to read the signs of where you are and what's happening with the snow and the snowpack.
Okay. I guess in terms of making those forecasters, you hire people that our longtime backcountry skiers like yourself kind of know what they're doing.
Well, so we have, you know, professional forecasters through the Forest Service. Mm-hmm. And so we're lucky we've got a host of folks who have, you know, decades of experience. And they are out looking at the snow all day, kind of every day. And then the forecaster of the day comes into the office at 4 a.m. in the morning and takes a look at, you know, what has the weather been doing the previous cycle, looking at all the observations, and then they write a report and publish that and put it out.
Yeah, you're a pretty flamboyant forecaster, Craig Gordon. He was kind of your outreach guy, you know, and he went into school. I mean, he was out and about all the time. Have you replaced him?
So Craig was one of the forecasters, and he has, you know, he's a force of nature, phenomenal personality, and, you know, really connects with people. But we have a host of forecasters who are out throughout the kind of 8 regions of Utah where we forecast.
Okay, 8 regions. I was going to say, are there other areas of the state that perhaps need more UTAV avalanche education or outreach?
Sure, there are. There are the more rural areas where maybe we don't have an established forecaster, so we rely on the locals who snowmobile and ski there to provide observations and to help us with those forecasts.
Okay. And again, as you mentioned, your funding comes from both federal dollars for the Forecasting Center with part of the Forest Service, and then we've got the nonprofit that supplements that? I mean, there's just not enough funding to pay for that forecasting service?
Correct. So that was really the genesis of the Friends of the Utah Avalanche Center 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago, mm-hmm. was to ensure that avalanche forecasting operations could be funded. So the UAC, 75% of our revenue comes from individuals and companies and supporters. So it's really very much a community-supported entity. And then about 25% is from grants. And so the state of Utah, specifically the DOR, has been really generous and helpful, family grants as well. So we're lucky that we have a lot of support kind of across the user base.
Great. And I got to talk about this. I mean, if the super El Nino happens and we get big snow as opposed to big rain, what should people be thinking about before they head into the backcountry?
Well, you know, they should be thinking about the conditions, what's been happening. And a great way to do that is to log on to our website or use our app, download our app, and get the daily forecast and just read the forecast, even though you might not be going out that day. To do that as kind of your daily routine will give you a better sense of like what the snowpack is doing and what conditions are like.
Yeah, what's the talk amongst you guys about Super El Nino?
We're hopeful. You know, fingers are crossed. We'll see what happens.
Okay, anything else, Naz, you want to tell us about?
No, I think, you know, we appreciate the community support and love to see folks at the Backcountry Benefit at Black Diamond on the 10th of September.
Okay. And again, people can get more information, utahavalanchecenter.org.
Correct.
Okay. Naz, nice to meet you.
Thanks so much.
Congratulations on the appointment. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Drivers may have seen new construction activity at Richardson Flat recently. KPCW's Christine Weller reports crews are moving contaminated soils near the park and ride on Larry H. Miller-owned property.
Construction crews began excavating contaminated soil in Richardson Flat August 4th under a federal and state agreement. Larry H. Miller Real Estate owns nearly 1,000 acres in Richardson Flat, east of Highway 40. The Utah Department of Environmental Quality told KPCW the company is moving the soil to make room for commercial development, recreational use, or open space. The area is part of the Richardson Flat tailings site, storing toxic soils with heavy metals like lead and arsenic from Park City's mining days. The DEQ said Larry H. Miller is moving about 10,700 cubic yards of historic mine waste to a tailings repository on the site. The repository was built to hold mining waste. The work is being done with permission from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the DEQ. The three-party agreement was signed March 9th. The EPA told KPCW the work plan includes provisions to ensure dust does not migrate off-site, including using stockpile covers. The excavation will end in August, followed by work to grade the site through mid-September. Grading ensures proper water drainage, slope stability, and erosion control. Larry H. Miller representatives did not respond to multiple requests from KPCW to comment on the activity. It's unclear if the excavation is related to a development agreement on a neighboring parcel annexed to Hideout. That land is also owned by Larry H. Miller. The company planned to start construction on the Silver Meadows project this year, which could have up to 600 housing units. The Hideout Town Council approved the agreement in October of 2020. Larry H. Miller also previously offered to build affordable housing on Park City's side of Richardson Flat. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
This is KPCW Park City at 91.7, 88.1 FM in Summit County, 91.9 FM in Wasatch.